The Pat Kenny Show
with MasterCard. Share in extraordinary experiences all over the world with priceless cities at priceless.com.
This is News Talk.
But first, Owen Murphy, Housing Minister, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, thank you.
Over the past couple of weeks across all shows on News Talk, we've been bringing you the Home Truth series. We've been looking at issues related to the supply of housing, the cost of rent and the pace and cost of construction. And we wanted to kind of summarise everything that we've been learning with the Minister here. The cost of building a house, the speed of building a house, your intentions perhaps are good, but the level of achievement has been very slow.
Well, on the speed of building a house, what we have done is try to cut as much red tape as we can around the planning process, things like the new fast-track planning process for larger schemes and for apartments, to try and make sure there are no unnecessary delays in the planning process, because that's the key part before you can even get on site and start building. We've also looked to make changes to regulations around what you can build, particularly when it comes to apartments, to make it more cost effective. Things like removing the need to have car parking spaces, increasing the number of units that you can have around a lift core, those types of things. But we have to be careful that we don't go so far that we actually undermine the standard or the quality of the homes being built.
Well, no. One of the things that caused a lot of headlines, and Kieran Cuff was almost losing the run of himself entirely, talking about Bartra's development in O'Leary, where he talked about 49 units, where the bed has to be a folding bed to work, where each little unit has its own bathroom, but 49 apartments share one kitchen. Now, that's potential slum dwelling.
Well, I can't talk about an individual planning application.
Why not?
But I will talk.
That's the kind of thing that your change in rules has allowed. And really, you know, there is an emergency, there is an urgency, but allowing developers to build for rental tiny little cubicles that masquerade as proper housing, I mean, that's building the slums of the future.
So that's not the intention of what we call co-living and the new guidelines that came into place. But, and I'll come back to that in just a moment, Pat, because you talked about the changes that we've made not working. But yesterday we got independent advice, information from the CSO, giving us the build numbers for the first 3 months of this year. More than 4,200 new homes built, completed at the start of this year. More than 5,000 started on site. Now, that 4,200 number figure is roughly about what we saw in 2013 as a whole. So construction is dramatically increasing. We're seeing 20 to 30% increases year on year, whether it's planning permissions, commencement notices, or completions. We are sustainably increasing supply. So before we can talk about things like, you know, the chap you had on in the intro, the difficulty with affordability, people not being able to get a mortgage together to buy a house, families in emergency accommodation, unless we're correcting supply, then we're not going to be able to address those other problems. Now, one of the questions is how do we address supply?
I mean,
and co-living is one of those solutions.
One of the issues is that developers can make a fortune out of the co-living model. And the idea of having people come in, developers of all colours coming in and building these kind of accommodations instead of building proper accommodations, it's not what we want. It's not the quality we want for the people who are desperately in need of a home.
Right. So the crisis that we face in housing, or the challenge that we face at the moment, as supply is increasing, is becoming more a question of not increasing supply, which is happening now quite dramatically, but what we're building and where. So it becomes more of a planning issue. So as we increase supply, we have to make sure we're building the right types of homes. That means student accommodation, which is now coming on very quickly. It also means accommodation for the elderly. It also means places to rent, because more people have been renting, and that figure has been increasing since as far back as 1991, I think, for a whole host of reasons. But one of the things that we have seen is that there is a group of people, particularly now younger generations, coming in to college, going into student halls, that type of very, very good now student accommodation, where they have their own bathroom and bedroom in a smaller size than you'd live in if you were a family or if you were renting long term, but much larger communal spaces because that's what they're used to. And what co-living is meant to be is the next step for that. So you've come out of student accommodation, you're starting your first job, you like socialising, you know, your idea around privacy are different. And so it's a type of student accommodation, yeah, but it's for the young professionals.
Have you ever
shared
a flat or a house with a few people?
I have. I mean, I was in student halls in London myself when I did a flat share in Geneva.
Yeah, and 49 people sharing a kitchen. Who stole my milk? Where did you put my salad? I bought that in the deli and it's gone. I mean, this is kind of madness. You know, because a student, I've seen student accommodation in DCU, I've seen it in Trinity and Trinity Halls, I've seen it in different places. And in those student bedrooms, you have a desk, you have some storage, you have a wardrobe, you have a bed that doesn't have to fold down, it's permanently there. You have a kitchen and living area that's shared maybe with 6 or 8 other students. That's it. Not 49.
Without talking to an individual planning application, because I am the Minister for Housing and Planning and that would be wrong, what you're describing is madness. What you're describing isn't the intention of co-living. We have very successful co-living models in places like London and New York where young professionals are living in this new type of accommodation for their first couple of years, just their first couple of years, and they're making certain sacrifices around space so they can live closer to work or at a more affordable rent, but only for a couple of years. And that's the idea of co-living.
Have you put
what
a price
you're describing
ceiling
is not co-living.
Have you put a price ceiling on what they can charge per square metre for those kind of accommodations? Because unless you do that, it's just more extortion and exploitation.
No, but it's interesting though that you're raising this, because we had a debate in the Shannon earlier in the week, and Michael McDougall was talking about the fact that when John Gormley moved to ban bedsits, he did it with the best intentions around standards of accommodation. But as Michael McDougall explained it, it poured more petrol on the fire in relation to adult homelessness. So as we do everything, we have to think about then unintended consequences. So what we're trying to do with co-living is bring around another option, another choice for people if they choose to go for it. And in the guidelines that we've published, it's about bringing forward apartments with some co-living space as well, so that when someone goes to look at a new building being built, say it's close to work, say it's within the M50, they can say, well, maybe I can afford that one-bedroom apartment, maybe I can afford that studio, but actually, if I pay a little less, I could go into that co-living space and have a bit more money in my pocket.
See,
it's
what,
to give
what,
them the choice to do that.
What we are concerned about, obviously, is that because there's so much money to be made from co-living by developers, that they will opt for this model rather than opt for sustainable, long-term apartment living. And even the ones that permission is given for regularly, there's no storage in many of them. Inadequate storage, no place. If you have any kind of a bulky item, like you have a Christmas tree you want to store, you've got a few suitcases you want to store, you have a bicycle or a kid's scooter or sporting equipment that you want to store, these apartments are not fit for purpose.
What we're talking about,
they're not fit for anybody, mind families.
No, but what we're talking about there is, and you referenced one example, so we aren't seeing this in a massive scale. We know we need to build more apartments, thousands of more apartments, and we are seeing applications for that increasing. But it's every type of apartment. Apartments for families to live in, apartments to buy, apartments to rent, and then things like student accommodation and co-living.
Why,
so we're trying to achieve a mix.
Why do our planners, and I mean, you're, as the Minister for Housing, you're responsible really for this at the end of the day in terms of leadership. Why can we not simply, instead of reinventing the wheel, just emulate the family living models that exist in all the major capitals of Europe? You've got storage in the basement,
yeah.
You've got apartments surrounding a good green space with playgrounds for kids. That's the typical model.
But we are doing that. We are now moving to a more European rental market. We are emulating it, and in emulating it, that's why we're increasing...
But no storage.
No, but sorry, but that's why we're increasing the build-to-rent sector. That's why we're increasing family apartments, and that's why we're also bringing in things like co-living and the new type of student accommodation that we've seen. These are all normal in other European cities because they provide more choice, and providing greater supply and more choice, you can meet the different needs of different households. Whether you're a young professional starting your first job and you're not sure where you're going to live in a year, or you're a family trying to put down roots in a community in an apartment for 10, 15, 20 years.
You probably heard some of the reports indicating that the cost of building a house, including the site out in places like Cherry Orchard, 210,000, they go to market. And yet, the average cost of a house in the Dublin area, in the close to the city, is probably nearer 500,000. If you go out a bit, it's 350,000 to 400,000. Like, who's making all the money?
Well, like, there is a real challenge at the moment when it comes to affordability. And we have done work in relation to the cost of building houses and the cost of building apartments. It's viable to do both. That's why we're seeing such a massive increase in the supply. We need to see more of an increase in the supply.
Are you having the wool pulled over your eyes once again by developers?
Well, if you look at the CSO figures from yesterday, again, they brought in figures in looking at house price purchases for the 12 months to March. What you'll see is the average price in the country, 1 in 2 homes were bought for less than €250,000. It's a different picture when you look at the greater Dublin area, Cork and Galway, where there's more pressure. 1 in 2 homes were bought for €320,000. So there's different affordability pressures. And then again, when you look at Dublin again, actually, the number of homes being bought for less than €250,000 falls to one in six. So there's different price pressures in different parts of the country. Therefore, builders can make more money in different parts of the country. Certainly, as we increase the number of new houses, we want to see more houses being built outside of Dublin to take pressure off the capital city. We want to double the population in places like Cork and Galway and Limerick and Waterford and many of our large towns. So there's more viability there for them to do that.
Is the state going to have to look at land banks again and decide which way to proceed? For example, if we do provide the land, for example, at whatever price, whether or maybe even leased to the developer and to the subsequent homeowner, so the state always has a lien on the land, we know what it costs to build a unit. We do. So therefore, if you can control the price of the land, which is in the gift of the state in the state land banks, you actually can control the final price of the house.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So there's three things that we're doing around land at the moment. The first was the vacant site levy, which we more than doubled last year. And since we brought in that levy on vacant site, which has an impact on the pricing of land, more than 42 vacant sites have gone from being idle and moving into construction. Another thing that we're doing at the moment is we're taking public local authority land and we're building affordable housing on that. We're going to be opening the first site next month. And what we'll be doing in that is we'll be selling the house to people, discounting the price of the land because it's our land and there was no effective land cost. And the third thing that we're doing around land is our new state developer, the Land Development Agency, where it's looking at both state and private land. And for the first time coming forward to develop that land for social and affordable housing, as well as normal private housing, because everyone at the moment in our economy is faced with challenges around housing. It isn't just people on the housing list or just young couples trying to buy their first home. Everyone is. So we want to bring forward state land for homes for everyone.
Now, the question of densification and, you know, a lot of people are saying that the appropriate place to densify is in the places where people work because you want to eliminate commuting if you can. What are you proposing to do in that regard? Because in the centre of Dublin, where most people still seem to be gravitating for work, if you look at the commuting patterns, you still have areas that are extremely low rise.
Yeah, we do. And that's why last year...
off O'Connell Street, public housing, two stories or three stories high, and places like Sean McDermott Street, literally a couple of hundred metres from the GPO.
Yeah, and that's why last year we changed the planning guidelines so that people could build a lot higher and also increase the densities as well, not just in city centres and not just in Dublin, but also around transport corridors too. What we're trying to do here is, yes, allow for very tall buildings that can have many functions from retail to commercial to residential, but actually it's more about increasing the shoulder height across the city. That's how you really achieve density. We looked at other modern cities that we know very well. Their minimum kind of building height is kind of five or six stories across the centre of the city. We need to achieve that in Dublin. And one of the challenges that we have, you know, when we speak about social housing is finding that mix as well of housing as we do that. It's much harder to, we don't have now anymore these large sprawling green fields to build large, very large estates. And even if we did from a commuting point of view or a quality of life point of view or a climate mitigation point of view, it wouldn't be the best way to do it. So densification is key. Looking at the existing infrastructure that we have, be it transport infrastructure or kind of social capital like schools and playgrounds and building around those. And that's why we changed the guidelines to try and encourage more apartment building. Be it in relation to build to rent or traditional apartments to buy and live in. And we want to then, with that, and we have brought new guidelines for urbanisation. You know, if this was a challenge about just purely building houses, bricks and mortar, it could be achieved a lot more quickly. But that's what I mean when I talk about a planning challenge. We are trying to build places, communities. Often we're trying to regenerate communities as well that were either never looked after, despite how well this country was doing in the past, or suffered because of the crash.
Some of the things you've done, obviously rent control and the so-called pressure zones, the landlords will tell you and your own department will tell you the number of landlords have said, I'm out of here. They don't want, there's so much regulation, the threat of interference with their own private property rights, you know, if they're told, by the way, and I heard Mary Lou McDonald on a few minutes ago saying that if they have their way, no landlord could ever evict someone into homelessness. In other words, the responsibility for homing someone would be the landlord's rather than the state's or indeed the person themselves. What's your take on that?
So time and time again, no matter how many times Sinn Féin bring an idea to the table, and often the times it's, you know, they try and portray it as this simple one-line fix will end homelessness. When we test it and look at it and see how it actually works, we look at and we see unintended consequences and we see it's a very bad idea and we tell them that and they ignore it. So on that particular point of view, if a landlord's going to sell their property, At the moment, they can, if there's no lease agreement in place, now they can't break a lease agreement, it's the same as the commercial sector, but if there's no lease agreement in place, they can serve what's called a notice to quit if they're going to sell the property. And what some of the NGOs have come forward and said that that should be illegal. And they're coming forward again with very good intentions. But what would happen in that situation is the landlord, if it were legal and it's not legal, would sell the property. The person buying the home would then have to evict the tenants. So you could find yourself in a situation where a young couple buys a home to live in to start their family. There's a family in that home who they now have to evict because they've bought it and is their right, they want to live in it. And they can't do that. Maybe the people won't live. So but a young family evicting another young family, it hasn't solved the problem. It's only moved it on to someone who isn't an experienced landlord.
Okay, but the point I'm going to make now is that doesn't it come down to the lack of professionalism in the sector? You don't treat the person who has a little house that they bought for their pension fund or, you know, to initially house their students in college and then they want a little income or whatever. They become landlords. They're not given the same tax breaks as the big guys who are coming in. These cuckoo funds and everybody else who are coming in, they're buying blocks or building blocks. The individual landlord is treated very differently.
Well, that's the problem that we have at the moment when we look at the rental sector. Everyone is talking about a more modern, more European style rental sector. And they're only looking at half of the side of the ledger as to how we achieve that in terms of the protections we need to put in for tenants. But if 70% of our landlords own only one property, 86% own only two properties, that lends itself to the kind of volatility that we're seeing at the moment. People leaving because they want to cash in on their pension. People leaving because their son or daughter are now at college age and they want to move into the apartment. People leaving because they were accidental landlords because of the crash and they want to pay off their debts. That then puts people in the precarious situation of housing insecurity, leading, unfortunately, to homelessness in many instances.
But, I mean, you're not going to replace all that rental stock overnight with the big blocks.
If we want to combat that, it means bringing in more institutional, larger landlords who come in and make a 20, 30-year commitment to being landlords, who have to obey the laws because they're responsible to boards or to shareholders. It's a very different type of model. What we actually want to try and achieve is a mix. It's not getting all of those 86% of landlords out of the market, but it's about bringing more stability by bringing more types of landlords in. And that way, with the new protections that we've just brought in for renters, we should have more stability around supply and then achieve a better balance in terms
of rent supply
and rent increases.
Of developers who, you know, having built a block or two or three of apartments in a particular location with planning, which is in the gift of the state to give, the local authority, then they sell out all, even though there are people in the neighbourhood saying, I want to downsize, for example. I want to move into that block of apartments, buy one of those and have some change. And then the whole shebang is sold to one of these funds who rent everything and no one can buy in the locality. Is that another unintended consequence of your policy?
We're actually coming back to the beginning of our conversation. If an apartment block is built for rent, it's built to certain standards that are less than, if you like, apartments that are built to buy, because if they're built to rent, you recognise that people aren't going to be living in them for 20 or 30 years. So they're different standards, a different type of mix, different sizes. It wouldn't be appropriate to turn around and then say, this apartment was built for renting to a different standard, to then sell it to someone to own and live in for the rest of their lives. Those types of properties are built to be sold from landlord to landlord. Again, that's how a modern European rental market works.
So if you'd pardon the vulgarity, you say that if you're building to rent, you build crap.
No, not at all.
That's basically what you're saying.
No, I'm saying it's a different
standard. You build to a different standard.
No, you build to a different standard. So people might rent a studio apartment, which is perfectly fine, but they're not going to buy and live in one necessarily for 30 or 40 years or raise a family. Recognising that people will rent for a piece of time in their life.
But some of these blocks have been built by, you know, to a proper standard
Our built-to-rent standards are excellent.
And then are sold.
Our built-to-rent standards are excellent, but they're built-to-rent standards. It would be against the planning law to then sell that for purchase long term. But the idea, and it's difficult to try and get a proper picture of it if people don't understand it, but the idea of a modern rental sector is landlords selling to landlords. So you never get this problem of tenants being evicted, which in your scenario is exactly what would be happening, and we don't want that to happen.
There's a final question I want to ask, and it is about the rush to solve the housing problem, which is, whether we like it or not, is a temporary problem. It is going to be solved in time by supply, but it can't, because it takes time to build. It won't be solved overnight. But I'm wondering if there's a touch of the baby and the bathwater. You know, the councils are encouraged to give approval for pretty much everything in defiance of their own county development plans. On the board, you know, a whisper from the minister to the board encourages them to do the same. So we destroy the fabric of the city. while we're trying to solve this problem. And future generations won't thank you for monstrosities here and monstrosities there.
Well, there's no whispers from me to the board. Any interaction I have with on board Planola in relation to planning happens through the formulation of new guidelines, new regulations, new laws that they then have to oversee. We have a challenge in housing. There's no doubt about it. We have to increase supply. That happens over time, but the reason it's happening so quickly is because of the interventions that the government has made, be it in relation to changing the planning code or just purely ourselves this year spending 2.4 billion euro of taxpayers' money building new homes. 50,000 new social housing homes will come into the stock over the period of Rebuilding Ireland. We haven't seen something like that in decades. We have to be very careful in what we do, though, of course, because there's no point in building for now to meet this current supply problem and then finding that in 20 years' time we've built in the wrong places. That's why I talk about it being a planning challenge. That's why we've gone for higher densification and more compact growth in our city centres and around transport nodes. That's why we're looking at things and saying, look, if you're building an apartment block on the Lewis line, you don't need car parking spaces. So what we've tried to do is avoid the knee-jerk reaction of just zoning green fields and condemning people to four-hour commutes and a really poor quality of life. It takes a little bit longer and it's a little bit more money to build apartments in cities, but it's absolutely the right way to go. And it's what we're trying to do in Dublin, Cork, Galway, Waterford, Limerick, like I said, and in our large towns as well.
There are so many more issues. I mean, I could come to you on the children's hospital and the commutes you're going to force on nurses who won't be able to afford to live in Dublin's inner city another day. And yeah.
Well, that's why we're talking about things like cost rental, places like St. Michael's in Inchicore, very near the hospital. Cost rental living, where you'll have 20 to 25% off the market price, making sure it is affordable for young nurses or people starting off in their jobs for the first time. And that's where things like co-living help as well, Pat.
All right, we will leave it there. Owen Murphy, Housing Minister, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.